The new novel, Lebanese Blonde, transports readers to Little Syria, a neighborhood in Toledo, Ohio that's populated by immigrants. We'll also go back in time to the 1970s. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Joseph Giha is a professor emeritus of the creative writing program at Iowa State University. He's also well known for his short stories. This is his first novel, and it takes place in the neighborhood he grew up in. This hour, we'll talk about the novel and explore some of the questions it raises about family and heritage. And we'll talk about Giha's own immigrant experience. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Joseph Giha is a professor emeritus of the creative writing program at Iowa State University. He's also well known for his short stories, and he has just published his first novel. It's called Lebanese Blonde, and it takes place largely in the Little Syria neighborhood of Toledo, Ohio, in 1975 and 1976. Hello, Joe.
Hello, Charity.
Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
And why don't we dive right in with a little selection from the beginning of the book so you can get us give us a taste of what it's like.
Sure. This is my opening passage, in fact. Before we know it, that was how Uncle Yusuf liked to begin his funeral homilies, with an American phrase he'd adopted to mean once upon a time. Before we know it, the ship stop in New York Harbor, he would announce to the congregation, and we step down on Ellis Island. Yusuf's voice was high-pitched, and he sprayed his S's, step, Elish. Children in the congregation tittered to see the spit fly, lifting their faces as they followed its arc up into the ceiling lights, and then down again toward the casket positioned directly beneath the pulpit between a double row of candle stands. The casket was kept open during the homily, awaiting the final administering of ashes and holy water. "He first come here," Yusuf continued, pointing down at the silk-covered face, "the same year McKinley was shot." Or, "She come the year before McKinley died." Or 2 years after. An assassination, rather than the turning of a century, was the hallmark by which an entire generation had signaled its arrival. Settling into America, they grew old with the century. And as they grew old and began to die off one by one, Yusuf spoke at their funerals. Archdeacon of St. Elias Church, educated in the seminaries of Antioch and Damascus, and so almost a priest, he would recount in the formal intonations of High Arabic how, before we know it, ticket agents were riding up Mount Lebanon on donkey back, sent by steamship companies that needed people to fill their steerage holds. In village after village, from the Bekaa Valley in the north down to the mouth of the Litani River, they announced cheap passage. Just imagine it, America, where one finds gold lying in the streets. At the beginning, only a few bought tickets. Those few, anticipating the crash of the silk industry and understanding that nothing would be left for them after that, not even the work their fathers had done all their lives long, said to one another, "Yalla, let's go." So they went, the trickle before the flood. For those who remained, mail began to arrive from America. There were letters to be read aloud by those who could read, and there was something else in the envelopes. American dollars. Wallah, they had indeed struck gold. Here Yusuf liked to pause, briefly raising both hands to his shoulders as if in benediction, his tiny frame so compressed by age he could barely see over the pulpit's lectern. So the rest of us packed up what we could not sell off, and we followed. They never came here to stay. Yusuf stressed this. They came here to take the gold back with them and live out their days like pashas in the most beautiful mountains of the most beautiful country in all the world. But, he would add, the first step away takes you all the way away. so that in the end, who remembers the old country? He pondered his own question. Over the years, Yusuf's eyebrows and mustache had remained black, while the hair of his head had turned gray. Forget the old country! You rolled up your sleeves instead. You learned the money first, then the language. Books and schools were for your children, and not for you. America grasps you by the ankles of your children. Here Yusuf would fall silent, wait for the high, piping echo of his own voice to fade. That trip back to the old country you were planning to take in 5 years? Before you know it, 10 years. Before you know it, 15. Before you knew it, a 2-week charter tour in the summer, excursion fare, after your children had sold the store. With luck, you can make it back in time to die in the shadow of Mount Sinin under the grape arbor of the village where your family name was born. But even that is not the end. No, in the end, your children will send for your body, have it boxed up, and brought back to America to be buried. Your dust, now American dust.
Joseph Giha reading from his new novel, Lebanese Blonde. And that's how we begin to get acquainted with this family that the book revolves around. And the main characters of the book are younger members of the family. But can you describe the family for me a little bit?
Yeah, primarily it's Uncle Waxy, who runs a funeral home with his sister Libby, Aunt Libby in the book. And it's a neighborhood area funeral home, primarily serving the Lebanese American community. It's called Little Syria because when they came over in the early parts of the 20th century, they were called Syrians, and they called themselves Syrians. Lebanon itself wasn't technically a country until 1943. But anyway, they lived in Little Syria, and Waxy has a son named Aboudi, and there is also a boy named Sam, who the main story focuses on, is Aboudi's cousin. And Sam lives with his mother in Little Syria and gets involved with Aboudi in some of his schemes.
And this family not only has the mortuary, the funeral home, mm-hmm. but they have small businesses throughout this neighborhood.
Yes, they have the Yankee Cafe. They have some small bodega-type shops around as well, yes.
And is this a family that, with your experience growing up in this neighborhood, is this a family that you would have been familiar with?
Yeah. The people are, of course, it's fiction. The people are made up, but they're founded on people that I grew up with, yes.
One of the comments that comes much later in the book, but I found interesting in thinking about how this family has built its fortunes around all of these small businesses and sponsored other relatives to come over the years. Mm-hmm. You write in one of the parts of the book that as the immigrants from Lebanon, from the Middle East, moved to Toledo, Ohio, and other parts of the Midwest, they didn't want to work for the factories that were drawing so many people from all over the country and all over the world to Detroit and Toledo and that mm-hmm. part of the Midwest. The factories were not for them. Why was that?
Well, the idea was to work for yourself, to be your own boss. They did, a lot of them did, of course. I had cousins and aunts and uncles who worked in, say, in Autolite in Toledo and Ford plants in Detroit. But the idea was to get out of that as soon as you could. One of the ways a lot of them did, and my father, who immigrated twice, really, once with us and earlier when he was a 13-year-old boy. He was a runaway, a stowaway, actually. That's another story. But he instilled that in himself and in all of us about how important it was to work for yourself. So one of the first jobs that Lebanese American immigrants did was to be peddlers. They went around with packs on their backs called kashis, like big baskets, and they were filled with pins and needles and scissors and cloth and yarn. And they would go door to door, you know, scissors misses, you know. And the idea was you saved up enough money doing that so you can open your own store. My dad did that as well as a number of other things when he was a young man. He was born in 1888, so he was 56 when I was born. So he had like the experience of most grandfathers I would have, you know, the generation I would have had. And so I used him a lot in the book. He is, of course, the basis for Uncle Waxy.
And I just think that that's a very important feature of this book, the fact that this family has built all of these small businesses, and the older generation is really enjoying the success of these businesses. They're financially very well off. But then you introduce us to these younger family members who, in many ways, don't seem to have that characteristic or, I guess, not necessarily characteristic, but stereotypical first-generation American drive.
Yes, that's true. They don't have the old fire in the belly. A lot of the immigrants, when they came here, had so little they had no cushion, no backup. And so they worked day and night. And they were eager to. They brought this, in a sense, this is part of, I think, myself, some of the vitality that immigrants bring to America, this urgency to work hard, to work well, to do well, to make good. And then so that your children would be able to have a different kind of life, that they don't have to work from dawn till dusk. That they can go to school and become professionals, if you know.
Your main character, Sam, or Sammy, he came with his mother and father, and he had a much older father, much like you did.
Yes.
When he was 8 years old. Mm-hmm. And so he had to learn English as he was going to school. He got held back twice in school because he was slow to learn English. And although he graduated from high school with honors, when we meet him, it seems as if the family has written him off as being a simpleton.
Yeah, he's kind of a screw up. He's the guy that you have to hit on the back of the head because the rest of the line has already moved on.
And all he can do in their eyes is drive a car.
Yeah. He's messed up so many times. And one of the things I wanted to do in this story was to present his coming of age. So I had to present him sort of as someone who has room to grow.
Well, we'll find out more in just a moment. I'm talking to Joseph Gieha. He is a professor emeritus of creative writing at Iowa State University, and he has written now his first novel. It's called Lebanese Blonde. We'll continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and my guest today is Joseph Gieha. He is a professor emeritus of creative writing at Iowa State University. He has written now his first novel. He's well known for his short stories, but he's just published his first novel. It's called Lebanese Blonde. And now I think we should introduce the idea that this is not about a Lebanese woman who has blonde hair.
No.
So we were talking before the break, we were talking about Sammy, who's really the one of the people that the book revolves around, and sort of his coming of age story. He's in his early 20s, a little bit of a screw up. He does a lot of the grunt work for his very large family in Little Syria in Toledo, Ohio. And he has this cousin who has a lot of get rich quick schemes.
Mm-hmm.
So tell us a little bit about Abuda, his cousin.
Abudi is exactly what he is. He's a go-getter, but he wants to do it quick. He has a bit of money from an insurance policy of his brother, Khalil, who died. And so he's to use this money to double it, but he wants to do it quickly. And so he gets involved in get-rich-quick schemes, which all fail. He joins up at this group that meets, and they have like evangelical meetings about business, and they work themselves up into frenzies of dare to act, and he tries to make some money, but he never succeeds, and then he gets in this one particular scheme, and he draws Sammy into it. But his idea is act like a big shot, and pretty soon you will be a big shot.
Right, even it, later on, dresses as a thin man, because
yes.
Soon he will be thin.
And he's not a thin man.
Right?
No.
So they get involved in a scheme, and Sammy reluctantly pulled along into a scheme to import hashish.
Yeah. That's my acid test. When people say Lebanese blonde, I say, well, then I know that they didn't know what it was back in the late 60s and early 70s. Right. It's the name of a very supposedly very fine form of hashish.
All right. And because they're setting up this deal, they also travel to Lebanon to meet with some cousins of cousins and set up their network. Although, again, Sammy didn't really know what he was doing. And when they're there, their paths cross with another character who is in your book and who we get to know much better later on. But perhaps you could read us the beginning of our introduction to that character.
Okay, this is the character who eventually become known as Tayyib, but he doesn't have that name yet. This is his story is told in an italicized segment following the end of every chapter until the two characters, Sammy and Tayyib, eventually do cross and meet later on in the novel. This is the opening. Khan Makan. When he tells his story, if he tells his story, this is how he will begin it. The way the Hakawati, the itinerant storytellers, begin with Khan Makan, the Arabic once upon a time, which means perhaps this happened thus, perhaps it did not. How else to relate his departure out of the Syrian desert, how he traveled west until he reached the green world? It's all Khan Makan, like memory itself. The memory of his childhood is a blur. His own age he cannot recount, neither the day nor the year of it. Born to desert herders, poorest of the Fillahin, to a forgotten name. Wla, his father calls him, as if summoning a servant, one more worthless than the white dust beneath their feet. He is not taught to read, can the dust beneath one's feet be instructed, nor to reckon numbers beyond his five sisters, one for each finger of his mother's hand. He recalls his mother's tattooed hand reaching to light a kerosene lamp, her hands shredding meat from roasted bones, showing him how it's done, waving him off, away from the fire, off to fetch her twigs of thyme, her fingers stripping the leaves from the thyme, rubbing the leaves between her palms, her eyes closing to smell her own hands. He remembers the early sun already hot, the yelping of wild dogs, and the long-eared goats, the Judas, dyed red-orange for easier spotting. The sounds of bleeding, the sad heave of the donkeys, and the smells. Orange blossom water, anise and mastic, dung, and the burnt oil bite of his father's rifle. The flies everywhere, the white dust everywhere, on everything, and kneeling in the white dust, his sisters, capturing scorpions, for the game they called Barbut. Five sisters in the wilderness of the desert where every daughter is a burden. Before they reached womanhood, their father sold them off, far beyond the mountains to the west, each after the other, Fillahin girls, to keep house for the matrons of Damascus or Beirut, to cook, to clean and mend clothes, and over infants. In return, a lump sum price is paid through a broker. It is abandonment, and it is legal. Their brother counts them on his fingers, one Hasna, the first to be sent away, bleeding like an animal. Then two, Rima, gone. Three, Fadwa. Four, Saha. Finally, even Basima, the simple, the always smiling Basima. Five. Five times he pleads as an elder brother ought, protests with anger and with tears, cursing his father and then cursing his suffering mother too for the silence of her suffering. And five times he is punished, bent over a water trough, almost a grown man by the time his last sister is taken away, to be given lashes with a goat's tether. Afterward, when he is caught trying to pilfer money from his father's satchel, they are paper bills called piastres. He does not know their worth, but surely there must be enough left to buy back at least Basima, who has been sold to a toothless old man. His father punishes him for the thief he has become. In fury, his father uses the stock of the rifle to beat him. Then he takes the goat tether and ties him by the ankles to the water trough. He leaves him that way, bleeding from the head, one eye swollen and closed, an entire day, an entire night. It is dawn again before he has worked both legs free. He flees west, traveling on foot and by night, despite the throbbing of his head, despite how the vision in his right eye blurs so that he must keep it half closed. By the second morning, he has reached the gardens bordering Damascus, watered by the river Barada. In the Hamadiyi suit, his hunger is such that he tries to steal food. The approach of soldiers' boots chase him away, the rhythmic scrape and stamp. That night he crosses the Barada River, knee-deep now in the dry season. Driven by hunger, he climbs goat paths up and up toward the distant thin plumes of cooking fires, far up into the wilderness of the Anti-Lebanon, where he leaves the goat paths, pushing through dense scrub to follow the waft and trace of hot, dripping fat.
Joseph Giha reading from Lebanese Blonde. And when I was reading the book, Joe, when I read that segment and, you know, continued on into the book, my original theory about this character was that he was one of the ancestors of this family in Little Syria, and it was somewhat shocking a little later to realize that, wait, this was taking place in the same time, in the 1970s. This is a contemporary story. Was that intentional to point out that this is not just a world away, it's a completely different world?
Yes, that's true. I wanted to make it as exotic as the language is obviously elevated and exotic, and I wanted that effect because of the world he's going to clash with later. I wanted to present him in that sort of a highlighted, as Arabic as I could without using Arabic. Yeah.
You came to the United States when you were 2 years old. When was that?
1946, right after the World War. We were the first boat leaving Beirut Harbor, and we arrived in 1946.
So I'm guessing you don't have memories of arriving in America, or can you remember anything?
I don't. My brother and sister do. They are a couple of 3 years older than me, and they do have memories of it. I don't. I only know stories like why we were processed at Ellis Island. Ellis Island, as you know, may know, was closed to processing in the mid-30s, but that did stay open as a medical station. And my father had sneaked my sister, his daughter, onto the boat when we were leaving. He had to sneak her on because she had typhoid fever. And he rouged her cheeks and tickled her as they were going up the gangplank so she wouldn't look so gorky. And we got past, and this is the story as I was told it. And we went down into where we were supposed to stay for the ship. I think it was down in steerage. And then as soon as we left sight of land, my dad took my sister up to the top deck. And the first officer he saw, he called him over and said, "Look, your ship has bad water. My daughter here is very sick from it." And they took her to the ship's hospital, and of course it was typhoid fever, and she stayed in the hospital the whole trip. When we arrived, we had to debark at Ellis Island. In fact, the whole ship was quarantined at Ellis Island because of my sister for 2 weeks.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, people were not happy with us.
You said that your father had been to the United States before.
Yes.
He came as a stowaway in his mm-hmm. teens. Where had he lived when he was here before?
Well, he came, he ran away from an abusive situation, as he described it to me, when he was about 13. He was around, it was around 1900. He was born in 1888.
And how is that in relation to when McKinley was shot?
That would be 1 year before McKinley was shot. He was shot in 1901.
All right.
But that is how they would tell it. Anyway, he came to the U.S. First went to the Washington Street, Little Syria in New York City in Manhattan, and stayed there a while, and then went off as a peddler. As I described before, the putting the pack on your back and going door to door, didn't even know English, eventually went to Chicago, where he did a number of things. Among them, he was a bootlegger.
And what took him back to what would become Lebanon?
That's an interesting story to be telling a lot of people at once, but he was a bigamist. He come to find out, this was not as unusual as it might seem. He married here in the United States, had a family. His daughter, Josephine, my half-sister, was about to be married to a man that my father didn't approve of. And so my father just left in a huff and went back to the old country. This was around 1930. Then arranged to have a marriage with my mother, had an arranged marriage set up. When my mother's family found out about his wife back in the old country, my mother was brought back to her family and lived for 8 years before returning to him, in a way sort of forced back. My mother came from a family of 8 sisters, and it was very similar to what I just described happening to Tayyip's sisters, that they were mostly married off to old men. In the old country, usually a man didn't marry until he had financial security. And my mother's family was very poor, very poor.
In the novel, Sam's mother and father, it sounds like a very similar situation where his father was significantly older than his mother.
Yes.
And that was not an arranged marriage that turned into a loving relationship. How would you describe your parents' relationship?
It was about the same. My mother admired my father for a lot of things, but it was not your traditional loving marriage, no.
And in the novel, Sam's father had already passed away, although there are stories told of him. And it sounds like some of those stories may have been similar to the stories told about your father.
Yes, very much so.
And did your dad know Al Capone?
Well, he was a bootlegger, I'd say no. But I'd love to say yes, because I'm fascinated by Al Capone. But no. I think not.
So there are some strong parallels between Sammy and you, although you came of age in a somewhat different time.
Yeah, but I was just as clueless.
Is he sort of your alter ego?
In a way, yeah. Sammy's like a part of me that was afraid to move out, afraid to step out into himself, into America, he kind of hangs back in Little Syria. And Little Syria in 1975 is disappearing. It's almost gone. The traces of it are, it's either, it's like being on a boat and the boat is shrinking while you're going to be in the water pretty soon. And so it was either sink or swim. And Sammy eventually will learn to swim.
Well, you came when you were 2 years old, so mm-hmm. although your first language was not English, probably, mm-hmm. I'm guessing,
yes.
You learned English also, I'm guessing, very young.
Well, I didn't speak English until I went to school. My mother spoke no English, and so at home we spoke all Arabic. And so it wasn't until I was sent to school when I was 5 years old that I began to speak English. And I do remember being teased for my accent and wanting very, very much to fit in and to learn the language. I think that it has something to do with me becoming an English professor.
You showed them in the end, right?
Yeah, well, yes, yeah, something like that, I guess.
And did you have a pride in being Lebanese as a child?
Both. I was proud, and I wanted to hide it. When I was went to the University of Toledo, and I was studying to be a writer under Gregory Ziegelmeyer, I would tell him these stories about my family, our first experience with an escalator in America. You wouldn't want to hear. But it was, let's just say they had to shut the store down to turn off the escalator. He would keep saying to me, why don't you write about these things? And I didn't want to. But I'm hearing music, so you would need
right.
Me.
We can talk, right. We can talk okay. More about that
all
in
right.
A moment.
Sure.
My guest is Joseph Guiha. He is the author of the new novel, Lebanese Blonde. It takes place in Toledo, Ohio in 1975 and 1976 in what was known as the Little Syria neighborhood of Toledo. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guest today is Joseph Guiha. He is an emeritus professor of the creative writing program at Iowa State University. He's well known for his short story work, and in retirement, semi-retirement, he has just published his first novel. It's called Lebanese Blonde. Lots of it takes place in the neighborhood that he grew up in Toledo, Ohio, known as Little Syria. And just before the break, Joe, we were talking about your feelings about your heritage when you were growing up and when you were coming of age. Mm-hmm. And this was something that you had mixed emotions about.
Yes. As I was saying that I had been trying to be a writer, learning writing at the University of Toledo, and kept writing these very generic stories that took place in this generic American city and unnamed and so on. And my professor liked my writing, but didn't like what I was writing about. And he kept saying, well, why don't you tell some of these stories? And the thing is, that was what I was trying to get away from. That was why I was writing these generic stories. I didn't want to tip about my background. And then finally, I moved away to Springfield, Missouri, where I began teaching. If I had to get away to realize what it was, what I had. I began to miss the food. I began to miss the people, the sounds of the language, and so on. Then I began writing a short story about the store on Monroe Street that my father had, and myself as a little boy there. And that was the beginning of writing about my heritage. It seemed I had to get away from it to begin to appreciate it. I didn't mind, I realized, being different. I thought that was the problem. I didn't mind being different, but I wanted to be different on my terms. So when I wrote the stories, I wrote them sort of iconoclastically. I didn't want to tell the traditional immigrant story. I wanted to tell the immigrant story that undermines a lot of our traditional sentimental notions about them. So I try to use a lot of humor and reversal of expectation in the stories.
Moving to Springfield, Missouri, and I don't know where you lived in between, but then eventually coming to Ames, Iowa, mm-hmm. you wound up in a part of the Midwest. You grew up in the Midwest, in Ohio, but you wound mm-hmm. up in a part of the Midwest where, although we have some immigrant communities, we don't have many large Lebanese immigrant communities.
Yes.
And particularly not where you are. How did that feel when you were out there on your own? You didn't have this community around you. Was that part of feeling released from it?
I didn't feel released from it so much as I began to re-embrace it. I realized that it was good to be different the way I was different. But to choose that, I think that's what I'm really talking about is the sense of nobody likes to be made to feel different. You want to feel different on your own accord because of what you do and what you decide and choose to do. And it was a little bit lonesome. I got hungry for the food. When I was first living in Missouri, I would call my mom and on weekends, because that's when long distance was cheaper. And I had a Lebanese cookbook that I got from the St. Elias Orthodox Women's Auxiliary. They put out a cookbook, and I would call her and tell her, okay, this week I want to make such and such. And she'd say, okay, read me the recipe. And I would read it, and she'd say, oh, no. We don't use garlic in that. We use lemon. I said, okay, so I'd scratch it out. I wanted to make it taste like her food. And in a way, food was a way that I was able to keep in touch with in a visceral way with where I came from. My mother was a wonderful cook, and I grew up eating only Lebanese food and despising it, wanting to eat hamburgers and French fries. And then when I got away, as I said, that was what I wanted, and I wanted to make it like hers. And now I teach cooking classes at Ames, Iowa.
There's a moment in the book where Sam has kind of a similar epiphany to what you're talking about. Perhaps mm-hmm. you could read to us from that part.
Okay. This segment, it takes place, the war in Lebanon is going on. It's 1975, and bombs are going off in different places. And this one happens to be a car bomb exploding in the Bourj Plaza in Beirut. And Sam is with the family. The extended family is meeting and having nightly dinners because Uncle Waxy's in the hospital. And they're all meeting together waiting for news from him. And while they're waiting, there's a report on 60 Minutes about Beirut. And the family all goes into the TV room to watch the news program, and they see the bodies of little children lined up and being stacked up after this car bombing. And then the phone rings, and they are told that Waxy has regained consciousness. There's a rush for the hospital. Of course, Sam is, as always, driving. And so he drives a Abudi, and three of the women, the older women, are in the back seat of the car, and they're all heading for the hospital. And that's where the scene opens up. "Listen, Bud," Sam began, "what we just saw on TV, those car bombs, one of them went off in the Hamra district, close to the American embassy. The announcer said that the State Department's already begun tightening travel restrictions to Lebanon." "So?" "So you think something like that isn't going to cause a serious hitch?" What Sam's referring to is the plan they have to import hashish from Lebanon. In the back seat, the women had gone totally silent with listening. "Not us," Abudi waved away the very idea. "It's not in our blood." "What's that supposed to mean?" "We're business people. Look at Beirut, built on international banking. Look at our history. Overseas traders, merchants, way back before Bible times even." Sam thought he heard a grunt of approval from the back seat. "So what?" he said. "So look at the news we're seeing now, and not that State Department crap. I mean news from the street. Some poor chump's grocery store gets blown to bits, and 2 days later, 2 days later, he's selling melons out of a pushcart, and he's turning a profit. They're business people over there, cuz, and business people don't let things stay bad. Not for long, anyway." "Unless the war itself happens to be the business." "What's that supposed to mean?" "Come on, Abudi. Don't you think somebody's got to be making money off all this?" "Somebody? More than that, a lot of somebodies. Sure they are. And a lot of money, too. But that's only for the short run, Sammy. In the long run, it's bad for business. Big business, that is. Me and the Matronis, We discussed all this, and they'll tell you the same thing. Soon as big business starts hurting, then the Zawami, and I'm talking the real movers and shakers, they'll step in and start applying the pressure to cut it off. You watch. We are peaceful peoples. And Afifi couldn't resist adding her 2 cents. By the way, Arabic does not have a P sound, so they substitute a B. In the rear view, Sam could see her adjusting the volume knob on the listening device hanging at her bosom. She is patterned on an older woman I knew back in Toledo. She had an odd hearing aid. One went into her ear, and the listening device hung at her bosom, and you should have seen her talking on the phone. She would have to hold the receiver upside down. "That's right," Auntie Abudi said. "We are peaceful people." But now Sam's mother also piped up, asserting in Arabic, "The most truly we are a peaceful people, and therefore we can hold our heads up to anyone." "I suppose so, Ma," Sam said. Excuse me. Abudi smirked, gave him a little nudge with his elbow. The two women began a running commentary that Aunt Nejla, seated between them, nodded in agreement and softly uttered Arabic encouragements. "We are lawful, Bibel. Na'am. We are honorable, Ma'lum. We don't do it, the shooting and the blowing up, Mazboot. No, that's the other Bibles do, not us, Hatmahi." "Other people?" Sam glanced up into the rear view. "Like who?" His mother was ready with an answer, and she smiled. "Il-Irish," she said in Arabic. "They are on Il-CBS every day, Il-Irish, not us." "Okay, not us." The traffic lights were all synchronized. Sam found a constant speed and began making them one after the other. A year ago, he might have kept the argument going, convinced that there was no such a thing as us. But not anymore. "There is no us," he used to think, listening to Uncle Yusuf go on and on about this small country at the great crossroads of East and West that had been repeatedly invaded over thousands of years by anybody and everybody, from Egyptians to Macedonians, from Mongols to Turks to European crusaders. "Australians, too, and the French Senegalese," Yusuf would hasten to add, recounting how the people of this small country were once natural sailors and pioneers, how they had founded Carthage and Syracuse, colonies on Malta and the coast of France and Spain, and some claimed beyond the Mediterranean, how they circled Africa and even touched, Yusuf firmly asserted, the coast of America 2,000 years before Columbus. "Us who?" Sam had concluded. "No such thing, not after all these years, not after all that mixing. How could there be an us?" But visiting the old country last summer had changed his mind. It happened during the time he'd been left alone in Beirut while Abudi went off to set up business arrangements. Like many of the city's high-rises, the building Sam was staying in had its balconied apartments stacked around the central shaft of an elevator. Ascending in the slow cage elevator, a person could hear everything in the building and smell everything, too. One evening, he was coming up just at supper time, and the shaft was fragrant with roast lamb, garlic and onion, cinnamon, the unmistakable aroma of toasted pine nuts, as familiar as the aromas of his growing up. But then the voices, too, began to sound familiar, funneling up the shaft in a noisy accumulation, dinner-time shouting from room to room and down the hallways, snaps and retorts, and the yammering laughter of a nervous people. "Is that what we are, then?" he thought. The thought flashed through his mind. A nervous people. His father had been called that. His father, who had been excused for being an old man, a sick man, finally a rascal, who, in frustration with age and illness, slammed dishes to the floor, who would not let things be but had to snipe and curse and say vicious things until Mama was in tears. He had heard these very same voices in his own house at dinner time, echoes rising up the shaft all around him, a pleading wife on this floor, a screaming wife on the next floor, another one giving back as good as she was getting. The old familiar curses of blood clot and blindness and fiery jannam and the red, and all of it in the same Arabic dialect he had grown up with, the same, after all those years, family after family, up that slow ascent. Some of the voices were only talking. He knew that. Light, affectionate talk, amplified by the building's hollow. But even the talkers, even the laughers, seemed to harbor a dangerous urgency, an out-of-breath readiness to explode into shouting. Somewhere below his feet, Sam heard something crash sloppily against a wall. He recognized the sound, a food-laden dish. Not all of us are like that, he reminded himself. And with the very thinking of such a thought, that there were those of another sort, others like Uncle Alex and the Yakubs who sat to quiet dinners and gave you Arabic blessings instead of these curses resounding up the elevator shaft, others who were kind-hearted and patient and more than welcoming, famously hospitable, with the very thinking that not all of us are like that, he began to understand that, yes, there is in us. There had to be, or else he would not have recognized it. And he had recognized it again this evening, watching those television children stacked in death against a wall, their dark eyes like the dark eyes of his nephews and nieces, of his own eyes in the old photographs, the whorled curls of their hair like his own hair, the same golden skin, those little teeth that should be smiling. Oh, yes, there is in us.
Joseph Giha reading from Lebanese Blonde. Joe, what made you decide at this point in your life that it was time to write a novel?
Well, actually, I had been writing it at other points in my life. This book took me quite a while to write. I like to say it took me about 5 years to write each time I wrote it. So I have been writing it, but being retired, I had the opportunity to sit down and go through completely and redo it and put it together.
And there are parts of the book that have been published in short story form or similar to it.
Yes.
So these are characters you've been living with for a very long time.
Yes. I look at the body of the work I've done as kind of a translation. I feel I'm writing to not my own people, but to the larger America. And in a sense, I feel like I'm translating my own experience, at least, of my culture to them.
What does it mean to you to have this book now published and all of these pieces put together? And this is, in some ways, your life story, but also your invention.
Yeah. It feels a sense of completion. People ask me, do I want to, what's my next book going to be? I don't know. I don't know if there's going to be a next book. Right now I'm painting and enjoying that. And if I have a story to tell, I'll go back and do that.
And cooking.
And cooking. I love cooking. I love, I love archery. I'm doing a lot. I'm very busy. I volunteer. It's retirement is something I've been training for all my life, and I got good at it.
Joe, thank you so much.
Thank you, Charity.
Joseph Giha, he's emeritus professor in the creative writing program at Iowa State University, and he has just published his first novel. It's called Lebanese Blonde. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Emily Woodbury, and Sarah Bowden. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Production assistance today from Caitlin Fry, with technical support from Melissa Weiss in Ames. Podcasting and on-demand audio of Talk of Iowa online, iowapublicradio.org. You can send us email anytime, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by the River Monks. I'm Charity Nebbe. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.